I'll let you.
Dude, okay.
I won't steal your moment. I won't steal your moment.
This is like the most, of course, this is Joel moment that I can possibly think of. Is like, there's some super awesome, you know, niche piece of technology that I'm ready to blow your mind about. And you're like, oh yeah, I use that for my terminal. Or like,
the most like a random thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Hey guys, real quick, I just wanted to tell you about our sponsor, ThreatLocker. Now wait, before you hit the skip forward button, let me just say this. Most of the stuff that holds my attention nowadays is Red Team stuff as well. But I sat down with the ThreatLocker team this past week to do a demo of their EDR software, and it was super technically fascinating how this thing works. So check this out. You drop this thing on a system, right? And for the first week or so, it's creating a policy and a profile for that system. It's logging all the executables, what child processes are being spawned, the files and their hashes, that sort of thing. And it's creating this policy, okay? Then after the learning mode is up, we're in secured mode, and that policy gets put into place. And anything that's not on that allow list is immediately auto-denied. That's the zero trust piece, right? So in addition to that, they've got a bunch of crazy features like ring fencing and dynamic access controls that would stop a malicious hacker at pretty much every step along the way. Actually, I was watching this demo and I was kind of freaked out because I have no idea how I would cope with getting dropped into a ThreatLocker system as a red teamer. Anyway, if you want to learn more about this, head over to threatlocker.com and request a demo. And when you do, ask for my boy Andrew. His demo was super to the point and he was able to answer all my technical questions. All right, cool. Back to the show. All right, dude, we're rolling. So I have literally been that, what is that, Charlie conspiracy theory dude this week?
You're just that like meme? Pointing. You got the string on the bulletin board.
That has been me this week with CSS Injection, man. There has been some really cool stuff popping up in CSS Injection. And actually, there's been some cool stuff that is like 7 years old at this point that I'm just now finding out about. That is absolutely amazing. So I'm excited to cover that today. But first, let's get to the news.
Joel,
with the news report.
So Space Raccoon.
All right.
Do you want to start with that one or should we start with? Yeah.
Let's go to that one.
Yeah. So Space Raccoon has a really cool blog post that he came out with talking about, universal code execution. Should we talk about the wording of that?
So I think it's interesting. Because when I went into this, I was like, okay, you know, that sounds real, real intense.
Yeah.
And as you start reading through it, first of all, let me just say it's extraordinarily well done research.
As always,
classic yeah. Space Raccoon stuff. However, there are a lot of conditions for this actual exploit to be met. And essentially what this article outlines is like some of the functionality surrounding Chrome extensions and how the developer documentation and some of the ways that you have to communicate with these extensions can be manipulated to result in code execution on the client, on the actual client running the Chrome extension in their browser. And I think I learned a lot about Chrome extension architecture from this one. And I think the way that he deals with essentially the massive amount of conditions required for this attack is pretty awesome. Essentially using large data sets to query Chrome extensions that fit a certain profile. But man, there are a lot of conditions.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it's like it's a great example of one of those sort of niche areas of research where once you start to dig into mm-hmm. how these things work, you find a lot of really interesting topic specific information about, you know, pitfalls or weird configurations mm-hmm. or just like strange behavior and stuff like that. And I think this is really, really useful as a whole. I haven't seen a whole lot of research done about Chrome extensions. And I know that there's a lot of programs that own or have a Chrome extension that's in scope usually. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people don't really test it because it's not very easy to test. It's kind of falls into that weird gray area of both like web hacking, but also code analysis type stuff. So there's definitely, it's very interesting. And
it's definitely fringe web hacking. You know, it's like there's JavaScript, you know, obviously heavily involved in there, but it's using a bunch of like Chrome APIs that's hooking. It's like a combination of desktop hacking and web hacking, which I think is a really cool area. And I don't know if you've seen the content calendar yet, Joel, but I added some stuff on there. And we do have an episode coming up soon on Chrome extension hacking, which is going to be super awesome. So I think this is a nice little intro into this. Do you want to do the TLDR for this one or should I?
Yeah, you go ahead because,
I did look into it pretty well. And essentially what he does here is he explains Chrome extension architecture. And essentially there's this whole concept of a content script, which is essentially a script that gets added to each individual page that is within the scope for that Chrome extension so that you can run JavaScript. And that JS code has access to the DOM, but doesn't have access to like JavaScript variables and stuff like that on the page. And so it's sort of living in its own little isolated world. I think that's actually the technical term, which is cool. And because of that, you know, there are some limitations on what it can do. And essentially one of the most common ways for, people to structure these, content, what are they called to get content scripts? There we go. I was like, wait a second, what is going on here? These content strips is to be able to communicate with the front end via post message. Okay, so you're sending a post message from this content script up to the browser extension, sort of back end, the post message listener that's kind of sitting on the back end, and then you're passing through that data to other sort of Chrome extension APIs, like for example the I can't get the name of it right here. It's the native send message, the one that allows you to actually send a message to a native application on the front end.
There's so many like terms and stuff that we're just not like used to. Again, this is like one of those weird, you know, it's such a niche area that has so many quirks just to that are specific to it.
Yeah. Yeah, and so there's this. I finally found the section of the app here. It's send native message, and essentially what that allows you to do from the Chrome extension backend is interface directly with a native application on the local device. So this is for stuff like using password managers and that sort of thing. And essentially, it just does this via standard in and out. And the whole premise of his research is like, okay, if there's a way for us to interact with these content scripts, and then that content script passes the message straight through to the backend, and then passes the message straight through to the native message API, right? Now we're passing this data directly through to a native application on the backend, and then that native application handles the user input in a bad way, then vulnerabilities can happen. So it's like, there's like a set of like 1, 2, 3, 4 conditions that must happen for this like attack chain to work. And then he's like, so it gets pretty complex, but here is this massive data set called the Chrome extension manifest data set that you can use to query. And then here's the semgrep rule. And it just shows how he takes, you know, these set of conditions, program, you know, writes a program to detect these and then sprays it across the whole data set and actually ends up finding a vulnerability in a plugin with like, what was it, like 2 million? I think there's 2 million installs on it.
Yeah. I don't think he mentioned what the actual one was, but he said it had 2 million users. Yeah.
Yeah. One such extension is the extension B, quote unquote, with 2 million installs, which is awesome. So it's really cool to see him sort of have an idea on how this research should work and then programize it and then find things that are actually vulnerable to it across the whole extension data set and then pop some cool bugs with it. Very, very well done.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's really like that start to finish of finding a bug, figuring out how to do it en masse, and then doing it like at scale and then reporting all that stuff. And, you know, it's really awesome to, you know, see a great example of that, especially in a niche research like this.
Yeah. Okay. So to try to be a little bit more concise and clear with my explanation here, okay? The content script has a post message listener. It takes data from that post message listener, sends it to the Chrome backend via send message. And then there's an insecure handling of send message. It passes it through to send native message, which is now hitting a native app on the actual device. And then the native app incorrectly handles that data and introduces a vulnerability in the system. The example that he has is like a path traversal to load a DLL. And essentially he forced the download of a DLL because he's got control of JS, right, in the browser. You can force the download and then loads that URL or that DLL from the path traversal on the back end and gets RC. So pretty crazy chain. Definitely worth a read because it helps me understand a little bit better how Chrome extensions work and what kind of functionality they have surrounding them. And I think, let me just add this one more thing. I think the fact that he talks about common patterns in Chrome extensions is like, that sort of stuff is really helpful to know because in order to get that intuition of like, what's a common pattern, what's not a common pattern, you have to read through a lot of Chrome extension code bases, which is going to take a lot of time. And Eugene saved us that time with this write-up.
Yeah, it's that sort of like meta-knowledge stuff. Like, what's all the ways to open or to reference a window in a browser?
Exactly. Right?
Like, that kind of research is it's really valuable, even when it's... I mean, as a whole, that's not really what the purpose of this blog is, but it's kind of just nested in there as a little treat, which is awesome.
Yeah, a little bonus. All right, so actually kind of a thin week as far as news goes. The only one that I had otherwise here, besides obviously all of the CSS injection stuff that I'm going to freak out about later on in this episode. I'm sleep deprived right now because I've just been I was laying in bed last night and I was trying to fall asleep and I was just like, my brain just kept on churning CSS injection stuff.
What is wrong with you?
I don't know. It's not even that crazy of a vuln either. It's like very fringe vuln.
Just like literally like lying awake at night, like restless thinking about CSS. Like
I've got problems, man. I've got problems. Okay. So before we get to that, let's cover this next one. Okay. So this one was just kind of, this is a tweet from Isida Aditya. Sorry, I don't know how to pronounce it. And I automatically put like a Japanese spin on it for some reason, if it fits to Japanese characters. But essentially what this person tweeted out was, a way to escalate client-side path traversals essentially in script tags using the built-in JSONP callback that's a part of WordPress websites, which we've talked about probably two or three times at this point on the podcast. So nothing super new there, but it did get my brain turning a little bit. And I wanted to shoot out a prediction really quickly and ask for the community to do some research or at least keep their eyes peeled for a variant of this, which is essentially if we can find something in like WordPress or Drupal or like some of these big for example, Cloudflare, CDN, CGI, right? If we could find something, right, you know, on these very widely used frameworks that allows us to arbitrarily control the response, the JSON formatted response, that would be extremely helpful for exploiting client-side path traversals, okay? So essentially here, you know, they have a JSONP callback. You're able to specify, you know, what JavaScript function is used to trigger the callback. That's great. We've talked about it a million times. What I want is an endpoint where I can specify arbitrary JSON in the query parameter, and it returns that JSON in the response. It just reflects it right down into the response. And the reason why that's extremely helpful is that if you have a client-side path traversal, obviously you're controlling where that API request is being sent to. But it is expecting the same, some data format back because it thinks it's communicating with the same API endpoint that it's always, you know, always communicated with. So what essentially needs to happen is we need to find a way for it to give it the data format that it expects in JSON as a response. And then we can use that to trigger XSS, you know, business logic bugs, open redirects. Like these are all cases that I've seen when you're able to actually control that arbitrary JSON response. And normally my go-to way to do this, Joel, is I redirect off the domain to my domain, right? And then I control the JSON response, but that requires an open redirect. And if we can find a gadget in like WordPress or something like that, that allows us to do this, then we wouldn't have to redirect off domain. We would just be able to do it with like a semi-open redirect or even a closed redirect depending on the domain.
Or even some sort of browser-specific feature. Mm-hmm. Like I know there's some really interesting research recently that I've seen about blobs. Like those like ephemeral sort of file blob things that are in the browser. Mm-hmm. And you can like reference them, and technically the origin is actually wherever they came from. So like if you have a blob that was created on example.com and you're referencing, like you have an XSS in that blob, for example, the origin or like, you know, domain, like window.domain or document.domain is going to be the host that the blob was created on.
Oh, really?
So I don't know if it has access to cookies and all that kind of stuff. I think there's some like weird limitations around that, but yeah, potentially also something like that where you have some sort of browser specific feature that would allow you to control the file contents would also be an interesting attack vector.
That would be really cool. Blobs, I think, have a custom scheme that's associated with
them. Yes, it's like blob:http.
So I'm wondering whether in these scenarios, in these client-side path traversal like scenarios, whether we could hit those. Maybe if there was like a redirect that was doing some domain level validation but wasn't checking the scheme or something like that, then you could definitely have something like that happen. But I like the way you're thinking, Joel. Thinking outside the box, some critical thinking like a hacker, aren't you?
I'm thinking like a hacker. Hey, where did I get this shirt?
critical. I love how I'm like obsessing over client-side path CSS injection and client-side path traversal lately, and this is, you know, these almost are never criticals, you know.
Almost never.
we gotta start talking about criticals. Well, actually, I guess on that note, I will take a tangent on something that is not here in the doc, Joel, which is that I'm giving a talk at DEF CON this year that I was also frantically preparing last night for the deadline that was last night, surrounding like some of the coolest critical reports that I've found over the past couple years of bug bounty. So there's 11 bugs in there. All of them are criticals, criticals. And so if you're interested in hearing a bunch of bug stories about those, definitely check out Bug Bounty Village talk that I'll be doing at DEF CON. I think it's entitled, I don't even know the title off the top of my head. I think it's like Top War Stories from a Tryhard Bug Bounty Hunter or something like that. So be on the lookout for that. Shameless self-promotion there.
Did you have to complete your slides like fully?
Yeah, dude. Yeah, review? I did.
Whoa.
I did. Which is like a pain because it's like a month in advance, and it makes sense because they've got a lot of stuff to recover or to cover and you know, assess, but man, it was a lot. Yeah, it's like 150 something slides.
I mean, especially this far in advance, that's a ton. Yeah,
I think we can make small modifications to it between now and then, but essentially they said it needs to be like as finalized as possible. And
wow. Like, okay.
Well, that's pretty.
No procrastinating allowed.
Yeah, apparently not.
Damn. Cool. All right, let's. You want to talk about your special critical thinkers release, and then we'll.
Okay. Yeah. Cool. So yesterday, very exciting. Yesterday, I dropped a passion project of mine that I've been working on for the past couple of weeks that I just kind of bulldozed my whole schedule and worked on this because I had the motivation. And that is essentially a full-time bug bounty blueprint, how to go full-time on bug bounty. It's like a 15-page document describing essentially if I were having a personal conversation with you and you were saying, I want to go full-time bug bounty, what should I do? This is what I would say to you at length. So it's very conversationally written. It covers a lot of topics, sort of ranging from what kind of difficulties you're going to face as a full-time bug bounty hunter, what kind of like personality traits I guess like motivation deficits you might come up against that are going to cause problems. We cover taxes, we cover like
all the good stuff.
Yeah, like how to collaborate with other hackers, how to quit your job and transition into full-time bug bounty, how to make sure your finances are squared in advance, and then essentially how to build a pipeline surrounding, you know, your bug bounty skills and keep on driving that stuff in to create a good consistent income stream for you that you can live off of. So it's not to toot my own horn here, it's pretty good. I think it's really good. And the feedback has been positive. So definitely check that out if you're interested, Critical Thinkers. If you're not a Critical Thinker, head over to Discord, check out the server subscriptions that we've got there. This book is only available to the Critical Thinkers. So even if you want, you know, go ahead, drop a sub. It's $25 for 1 month. Grab the book and bounce. That's fine too. But in that 1 month, I think you'll find Critical Thinkers tier is something special, man. There's a lot of great conversations happening in that sort of exclusive Discord channel, and a lot of cool scripts, a lot of cool techniques, good conversations happening in there. So check it out if you haven't already.
Yeah, absolutely. It's exclusive masterclasses and stuff too. All we do masterclasses at least once a month, or hackalongs too. And we record all of them. We put them all in there. So yeah, historic, you know, you have months of back content that you get access to, and so lots of really cool features if you want to go check it out.
Yeah, absolutely. One other cool feature that is actually in the Critical Thinkers exclusive content channel that I wanted to just kind of shout out is the client-side path traversal browser extension that me and Bus Factor wrote. Bus Factor is a very valued member of the Critical Thinking community. And we were just kind of discussing what it would look like to build a browser extension for client-side path traversal. And I like threw some kind of junk code at him. I was like, this is kind of roughly how it would work. And I come back the next day and he's like converted it all to TypeScript and like has a build flow and like all these nice little buttons and stuff like that. And I'm like, oh man, this rocks. So I kind of took it from there as well and did some additional modifications for it. But at this point, it's pretty good. It detects pretty consistently when you have data reflected from the query parameters, the hash, a couple other areas into the path of a sub resource, you know, request, whether it be like an iframe or a fetch or something like that. Those are things that we all want to know about. So we have that extension available to the Critical Thinkers as well. And I think probably at some point we'll release it probably within the next year or so, but I definitely want to refine it a little bit and get it to a spot where, you know, some of the difficulties are ironed out, some of the false positives are ironed out before we release it full time.
Yeah, I definitely have a couple of really good plugin ideas in the pipeline, I think. I know we've talked about a variety of different things. Some of them we may have even cut out of the episode recording. So we'll definitely be creating those and releasing those eventually to the community as we go, just for our own purposes and also just to share the knowledge with the Critical Thinkers. But yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Hey guys, real quick, I just wanted to give a shout to the Hacker Content team. They have been absolutely killing it the past couple months, taking the content from the podcast and condensing it down into consumable social media posts, whether it be shorts or text posts or whatever. They've been rocking it. So I just wanted to give them a shout out and let you know that they do all sorts of cybersecurity content as well as social media management. They do technical blogs. They do comprehensive social media management. So if your organization could benefit from any of those types of services, make sure you head over to hackercontent.com, drop them a line, and mention the podcast when you do to get your first month of cybersecurity content marketing services for free. All right, that's it. Let's get back to the pod. All right, man, the moment has come. CSS injection time.
Your moment.
My moment.
Unfold the conspiracy theory.
All right, man. Here's what I got, okay? So I didn't know until last week that CSS injection has been pretty much completely solved. Prior to this, I thought that essentially we had a really reliable way to leak the contents of like attributes and that sort of thing. But actually, it is possible to leak the content of a text node as well, right? Just the inner HTML or whatever of a specific element, if that's text.
Does it require user interaction?
So, I mean, of course, the user has to navigate to the thing, but once they navigate, as long as you can do an import from a remote CSS page, I guess, then you're good to go.
And you can block that with CSP, right?
Yes, you can. So if we're talking about remediation methods, CSP is pretty much the best way to do this. Obviously, okay. Besides like not introducing the vulnerability in the first place, which I think is not too hard to do with CSS injection. Like you need a pretty niche scenario for CSS injection to happen in the first place. But I guess
it should follow most of the same like instances of any other type of XSS or HTML injection, yeah. Right? Where you're just some sort of content is making its way unsanitized into the response body. So in the same way that you would sanitize any of the rest of those, you'd probably fix that as well, right?
Yeah, exactly. But we don't need to dwell on how to fix it, Joel. We need to dwell on how to exploit it, okay?
Just some of us do.
Take your program manager shit away from me, okay? Like, we don't need that right now. This is my moment. Okay, so there are two things that I kind of want to talk about today and give the listeners a TLDR on essentially what CSP injection has to offer. And like how to actually exploit it, okay? So first one is, of course, the one that I think most people are familiar with. This is the one that I was using to exploit CSP injection up until this point, which is essentially the research done by Donut using sequential import chaining. And
was this back from like Singapore, right? Was it that event?
I don't know when he originally came
Vegas
out with it.
Or Vegas or something? I remember it was a while ago.
Yeah.
Pre-COVID.
No, yeah, it absolutely was. And it's been out for a long time at this point. But essentially, this is the whole concept of like, you have a CSS import statement, right? You've got that like at import feature with CSS. And you import a remote style sheet. And that style sheet includes another remote style sheet and does some CSS rule that will trigger a callback, right? And what will happen is you don't, on the server side, you don't respond to that second style sheet import until you've gotten the callback from the first set of rules that you put in there to leak the first character or whatever, right? Once you've done that, once you've got that first character leaked, then you respond and you do the same thing recursively until you have leaked the whole content of like an HTML attribute. And the whole reason why this is possible is because you can use the starts with selector for CSS stuff. So essentially you're doing a caret equal sign and then, you know, whatever value, and you're able to specify, okay, if the attribute starts with this, then, you know, trigger this HTTP request via like background image or whatever. Since you're able to do that, you can just character by character just brute force out the value of these attributes, which is super cool. And has been absolutely very, very relevant and very much used in the community for CSS injection, and it was what I was using up until this point to prove most of my impact. This was, and just to be clear, this was released by Donut and another guy, Pepe Vila, at the exact same time around 2019 range. And so that is a well-established technique. You knew all that, right, Joel?
Oh, yeah.
Of course.
All that.
Yeah, because I know how much you love CSS injection and all these little fringe web vulnerabilities.
You know, but on the dark net, they call me the CSS injection master.
Thanks for that, man. Okay, so cool. So I went in the rabbit hole this week because of some other things that I'll mention later. But while I was in that rabbit hole, I found a little bit more research on this specific technique that I didn't know about before. So I wanted to share it with the community, which is this technique. It's pretty fast. I think it only takes like a couple seconds to maybe 10 seconds or so to leak a decent sized token. But you can double the speed of it by also simultaneously selecting from the backside of the attribute, the HTML attribute.
Wow,
that you're
this
trying
suddenly
to,
became
to...
a computer science leak code problem.
Right. So it's like, you know, you're brute forcing the characters, you're coming in, and eventually you're converging somewhere, right? And I thought that was really interesting. It doubles the speed and it makes total sense why that would work. So cool little addition there.
That's awesome.
The other thing that I wanted to kind of shout out in this same like leaking attributes section is this repo by Portswigger Research called CSS Exfiltration, which I think was a repo that was related to like some write-up they did back in 2020, I believe. And
this was like recent Gareth Hayes research, right?
So this was not recent.
Or the blog or the exfiltration thing was. I mean,
so recently Gareth Hayes came out with a blog post on blind CSS exfiltration. And this was one of the things that like kind of triggered me a while back into CSS injection. Very cool project. I think we've talked about it once or twice before on the pod. If not, just Google blind CSS exfiltration. It's literally the only article on it out there because what talk about a fringe piece of security research. Like that is the epitome of fringe. But this is actually something different, Joel. This is some research that he had done years before. And it's really interesting because this repo contains like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, like over 10 different techniques for leaking characters from different contexts via CSS injection. So he's got like steal n characters in Firefox, steal reverse Firefox, steal script contents, like all of these various.
I mean, like I'm on Shads.
Seriously, man, it's like he's got a bunch of really cool ways of doing this. And one of the ones that kind of stood out to me, and I was like, oh man, I didn't know that was possible, was that you can steal the contents of an attribute by using the attr function in CSS. Okay, check this out, Joel. I'm gonna link it to you in because I don't think I put it like super clearly in the doc.
ATTR in CSS.
Yeah. So click that link that I just sent you in Discord. Okay. So on line 5, we'll drop this in the description. On line 5, yeah. There is essentially a content CSS attribute that is defining a property in CSS. And the value of that content, so the content is, of course, used to add like a prefix or a postfix to a specific div or whatever. The content of that is ATTR function call and then the name of the attribute. And essentially what that will do is set the, in this scenario, the after content, so the content that comes after this div, to be this value of a specific attribute, right? And then you can style that after attribute with a specific font that will exfiltrate all the data from that. So this whole like ATTR function in CSS, I think is really fascinating that you can access HTML attributes and stick their content into the content property in CSS. I'm curious
how far that extends, because I know that there are certain like weird things, like doesn't dot value like implicitly contain like whatever you've put into like a form input, for example, right?
It does.
So like would the value attribute from CSS on a form input contain that value, or would it have to be explicitly said? I don't know.
You know, it's funny you mentioned dot value, because dot value is a little weird, right? I feel like there are some frameworks that will like automatically update the dot value, or like essentially the value HTML attribute. And I know that if you use like in JavaScript, if you use dot value, that it just dumps the content of a like an input field or something like that. But I think sometimes it doesn't update it for things like HTML and CSS. It just does it in the JavaScript context. So that's an interesting question. I'm not sure the answer to that one.
Yeah. But I'd be curious to see if there's other, you know, weird cases like that, or any implicit attributes or anything like that, like that's exists but isn't, you know, visible all the time, stuff like that.
You're starting to feel it, right, Joel? Like, this is interesting shit, right?
It's super weird. I mean, it makes you wonder, like, why does something like that exist? I don't know. I'm sure there's some use case, and there's probably some other weird edge case stuff that exists just like it.
Well, CSS injection, or CSS in general, is just getting stronger and stronger and stronger, right? As they introduce new features. So that's one of the things that I like really keep an eye out for in the browser change logs, is like, what features are they adding to CSS and how does that affect our current understanding of CSS? And I was a lot more motivated to do this when I thought that text node content, so essentially if you have something in like, let's say inside an H1 tag, you want to leak like, you know, hi Joel or something like that, you want to leak the person's name. I thought that was not solved, but that actually is solved, which is crazy to me. So now I'm a little bit less motivated. To be honest, this has been a little bit demotivating, this whole research thing that I've been on. It's like, oh, well, they figured it all out.
But now you know.
Yes, now I know. And so, before we get too far down that path, I'm going to go ahead and paste this this link, a link that I was talking about in the doc. See, you know, many other podcasts, other YouTubers even, they forget to put the links in the description. You have always a critical thinking.
Not us.
We don't forget. We don't forget.
Unless it's a masterclass that I ran, and then it takes me a week of forgetting.
Joel, what are you doing? I did it, man? Though. Oh, man. All right. So CSS selectors to leak the contents of HTML attributes. Boom, done. Of course, that's done. That's been done for a while. But the problem is nowadays we have single page applications that are pretty much everywhere, right? And they don't often have input fields with pre-populated values like CSERF token or like API token or something like that. Oftentimes that gets stuck inside of a script text node, right? And just populated directly into JavaScript as a part of like those, I don't know, what are they called? It's like seed data almost for the page. It's like a JSON blob.
Yeah, like the state or whatever. Yeah, that, like the state. That, yeah.
Exactly. The state like JSON blob, right? That's where all the juicy stuff is nowadays. And that's why this research is so crazy.
Which, by the way, is so awesome when you find like a single XSS, because then you just have one giant JSON that's included on every page.
And exactly. Has just like user token
and all the config parameters. It's so nice.
Window.state. So yeah, exactly. Exactly. Love that. And we can do that also with CSS injection. Okay. And the way we do this is via this crazy, absolutely nuts technique that I love.
I always know when Justin puts a tweet in the doc that is just written entirely in Japanese and is like 3 days old. That's going to be some crazy, crazy research that he's about to try.
So Masato Kinugawa does some amazing, amazing research, man. And so lately what he's been up to, which triggered this whole thing, was he tweeted out in Japanese about some of the research he's been doing on font ligatures and how he's been applying that to Lava Moat, which is Lava Dome in particular. Lava Moat, I think, is the company above it. So check out this product, Joel. It's like a little bit further down in the doc, but like essentially this product, Lava Dome, is a DOM element isolator. So essentially you can have a piece of the DOM that you just cannot get the value from JavaScript. You can have XSS and you just won't be able to like get the value out of this this piece of the DOM.
Why not?
Well, they isolate it out. They do a bunch of just crazy stuff to block it off.
In native JavaScript?
Yeah, yeah. So like you literally can't get it. And there's a bunch of conditions to it, right? So if you go to the Lava Dome JavaScript
solvable problem, is it?
Yeah, pretty crazy, right? They think they can actually isolate a node from the rest of the DOM and you just can't touch it. And they call it like, you know, shadow DOM.
Once a juice case is like a feature for MetaMask's show private key toggle, which exposes the private key in plain text. Currently the sensitive content is attached to the DOM once it's exported, making it fully accessible to all NCs running.
Right. So they're saying,
but we believe this is a whole problem.
The whole concept of this project is quote, "We live in a world where we can no longer trust the code in our own apps and same origin execution does not guarantee safety." And I'm like, okay, all right, let's go. And it's amazing because they're essentially trying to protect the value of some, you know, HTML inner text from themselves, which is like a very difficult problem to solve. And I can just like, the moment that Masato Kinugawa started looking at this project, like, it's over, man. Because there's a bunch of like issues in this project that he has submitted, like leaking the values of Lava Dome via character height and font ligatures and mouse over and text fragments. And like, there's just a bunch of crazy ways that he's done it. But overall, I mean, very interesting project. And I think most of the time, the approach, like they mentioned in their README, is to actually put that sensitive content in an isolated iframe. But apparently they say, you know, you could put in an isolated iframe, but that doesn't feel as cool or something like that. And why don't you put it in Lava Dome instead? Which is like, okay.
Yeah. Okay.
And then Masato Kinugawa is like, no. I will not allow for this. So essentially, he's tweeting out about all of these different ways to steal it. And one of the ones that he tweeted out was very much related to CSS injection, which is essentially like you can use font ligatures to leak the content of this you know, sort of encapsulated DOM. Okay.
Yeah.
Do you know what a font ligature is, Joel?
I do know what a font ligature
why
is.
Why do you know what a font ligature is?
Because I use font ligatures.
What?
Yeah. So, okay. So
of course you do. Of course you know about
this. The TLDR here is that the terminal setup that I use, it uses a font that uses ligatures specifically in both VS Code and iTerm to convert like double equals into a fancy thing or triple equals into a fancy character or equals right arrow to a fancy arrow and that kind of stuff. So do you know? Here, what? I'll let you.
Dude, okay.
I won't steal your moment. I won't steal your moment.
This is like the most... Of course, this is Joel moment that I can possibly think of. Is like there's some super awesome, you know, niche piece of technology that I'm ready to blow your mind about, and you're like, oh yeah, I use that for my terminal, or like
the most like a random thing,
exactly,
yeah.
Like just like absolute tech enthusiast shit you could possibly think of. That's hilarious, dude. Okay, so font ligatures. Essentially, what this allows you to do is when you have a custom font, you can specify a sequence of characters that has a custom glyph. So glyph being the sort of actual visual representation of the character. Yeah. So essentially what you can do is you can define any length of font ligature. So you can have a font ligature that's like 35 characters long or more, right? Where if it sees this 35 character sequence, it displays it with a separate GIF. GIF does not display a GIF.
Glyph.
Thank you. All of a sudden, you start typing, and then all like the conspiracy Charlie pops up or whatever. Oh man, it's so good. So anyway, you can define these special ligatures, and this allows you to actually leak the content of a text node. So very similar to what you're doing with the CSS selectors. Essentially, you can have it, you can load up a custom font into this specific text node, and then that font has these ligatures, and if everything else, every other character A through Z, you know, 0 through 9, that sort of thing, is set to a zero width character, you can control the width of the characters in the font, the custom font creation process. But the ligature that you're trying to leak is massive, you know, it's like 10,000 pixels or something like that wide, okay? And then you style the container that this text is in such that if it's above a certain length, there is above a certain width, there is a scroll bar that appears, right? So that can give you a binary yes or no on whether this ligature is actually created or not, right? Because when the scroll bar appears, you can style the scroll bar to have a background image that will reach back out to your server, right?
Okay.
You see what I'm doing here with the
Shadow DOM.
Yeah.
Shadow DOM, by the way, that's a whole rabbit hole too. I'd never heard of that, and it's just like, yeah.
Is that what you've been doing for the past couple minutes while I've been explaining this, Joel?
I was in the beginning, but I am paying attention. I'm paying attention.
All right. I can see the classic moment when Joel says, Shadow DOM, that sounds either... that sounds interesting in so many ways. So anyway, font ligatures, super cool. Essentially, what you have to do to make this whole process work is you've got to set up a recursive CSS import, like we were talking about in the beginning, a la Donut and Pepe Villa. And what?
It just sounds like a meme. I don't like Pepe Villa. Like,
I mean, am I saying the name
right?
You
sound like Twitch emotes.
It does sort of like, oh shit, because it's like, I am saying the name right? Oh geez, that's going to be sorry, Mr. Villa, if I am not saying it right. No, I mean, that's the name, so... Wow, you just made fun of this guy's name and his amazing research on CSS injection.
It's a cool name.
It is.
It was the cadence. I don't know.
maybe it was the cadence. Okay. So anyway, you use the recursive import. I'm just going to call it Donuts Research via Donuts Research there, right? And
just like I'm not going to risk triggering him again.
His name has been erased because of your tendencies, Joel. And so you're essentially recursively importing these style sheets. You're waiting for the callback before you respond to the next one. And essentially each time you're forcing the style sheet to load up a new font, which you are dynamically generating to have ligatures, which are expanding with each character that has been leaked. And the way that the character is leaked is via essentially a Boolean of has the scroll bar appeared or not. And so here's where...
Which is detected by the background URL on that scroll bar.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But here's the thing that I'm thinking can be optimized a little bit, okay? We can use animations to change values of CSS over time. So we can say like, all right, now it's this font, now it's this font, now it's this font, without having to do a network request, except for the font, of course. So I think that would be really interesting. And I think since it's a you know, sort of a Boolean yes or no, you kind of have to load each character until you get a hit, right? So is it an A? No. Okay, next one. Is it a B? Yes, no. You know, is it a C? You know, that sort of thing, right? And I'm wondering if essentially we could reduce the complexity of doing this search by creating fonts that have ligatures that essentially do a binary search on the possible character set. So it's gonna have a wide length if any of the following characters appear in the sequence, and it's gonna not if the other half, and then you're halving it each time, right? So if you're dealing with like a 256, you know, standard ASCII character set or whatever, which I think there's less displayable characters, but whatever, then you know, you need a maximum of like 7 or 8 requests to brute force a character, which is like not that bad.
Okay, yeah. Hear me out on this. Hear me out.
Okay,
I've been brainstorming.
Uh-oh.
Okay, I've been thinking. Uh-oh. Joel's using his brain. Careful. Okay.
I kind of need you to help me with this, dude, because I was trying to apply it yesterday, and it's just kind of blowing my mind. So
I was just thinking, like, I was thinking about fonts as a whole, because I know that there's been like very niche research about like using fonts in this way as like basically kind of like a blind injection where like you have some sort of other signal that you're reading as like a canary to figure out whether or not this is working or it's not working.
Sure.
And
are you talking about the Unicode custom code point stuff?
Well, if you define a custom font, I mean, you can make those characters larger or smaller. Like you can change how they render and like what they display as. So if you can get a custom font in the page at all, and you just change the font of everything, I'm wondering if there's some way where you could basically have each character be a different size so that you could just take the width of an entire element and then you start to subtract and you go, okay, can I subtract 26 from this? All right, well, there's a Z in it. Can I subtract 25 from this? There's a, you know, a Y in it or whatever, like something like that, where you could basically do some binary math or some sort of derivation off of the total width based on the unique widths of each character within the character set.
Yeah.
And then figure out what's in it without having to also, yeah.
See, this is great. I need to nerd snipe you on this because I know that something like that is possible. And that's what I was thinking about last night when I was sitting in bed, staring at the ceiling, like how, and essentially the problem then becomes, how do you determine remotely what the width and height of a character of like a specific div is, while still doing some semblance of word wrapping so that you can control the number of characters that you're applying this to, which gets really tricky in the CSS world, is like, okay, wrapping is highly correlated to the width of the element. And so like, the CSS properties just don't like to work together in such a way that you can isolate the characters so that you can detect how wide the actual thing is or the actual container is, and expand it in such a way that you're like, okay, there's three characters in here, and now there's four. All right, now I can look at the, you know, the width and the difference in width or the difference in height, like Masato Kinugawa does in other spots in this research. And it becomes a tricky problem. And the cool thing about the Lava Dome thing is essentially what he's able to do is check that height and width via JavaScript, because you have JavaScript execution, right? So essentially he's using the style width and style height properties. This is in a different bypass to Lava Dome than the one we're talking about, or Lava Moat. Lava Dome?
No, all right,
Lava
I got Dome. You one. I've got you a potential thing here.
Oh my gosh, okay, Joel, so you're not listening to anything I'm saying. You're researching stuff.
There's a CSS selector called First Line. Are you aware of this one?
Yes, I'm aware of it. I've been using it all the time. That's exactly what I'm talking about. The problem is it's difficult to get the right amount of characters on the first line, right? And that first line selector is like absolutely revolutionary. You have to use that in a bunch of CSS selection techniques. But getting the correct characters to like bump onto that first line and then be able to tell the width is tricky, man. It's tricky. We'll do some research together after this episode, and then maybe we can come back and present it. But I'm running into some difficulties getting all this stuff to work.
Yeah, I think we'll have to check there, because there are a lot of different CSS like measurement selectors, you know what I mean? Like P, mm-hmm. PX.
Yeah.
There's one called CH.
Yeah, that's the character. How many characters are on the line? Yes. Yes, you're getting it, Joel. You're seeing the craziness that is the CSS injection world, right? So you can set a specific amount of characters to be on a line, and then on that, then measure the length of that line, right? And you should be able to determine and the change to the width of that line should be able to tell you the value that was added, right? But it's not that
simple.
You
can simple. Do math in CSS too. Like, you can multiply and stuff. Did you know?
Maybe it is that simple. I don't know.
There's a calc function.
I've got like 17 astif1, astif2, astif3.html files with lots of different CSS in them that I'd like to
show
you.
What about break word too?
Yes. Okay. See, Joel, this is why you need to go and read the exploits that I put into the doc before the episode, because all of these things that you're discovering are in the doc. Yeah, no, triggered, man. Okay, so let me get back and actually add some value to the listener really quick, okay? And instead of you and me just doing our exploitation flow like we always do. The thing that you need to know, in order to do HTML attribute exfiltration, you use the sequential import chaining from Donut, and you use the CSS selectors from the front and from the back to make it super fast, right? Or you can just use Donut's tool, does that, very well established, battle tested, boom, easy peasy. To leak text nodes is a little bit more difficult. I don't know if I'm gonna get it done in time by the time that this episode airs, but I'm trying to get a pretty cool tool in place that will essentially be the equivalent of Donut's sequential import chaining tool, but for leaking the value of text nodes via dynamic ligature generation and that sort of thing. And there are some POC codes out there by Michael Bentowski, who's the guy that came up with this original research back in 2017. And very sketchy POC code, you know, it's like just very, you know, he just finished it and put it up, and it's great and it gets the details across, but I'm trying to get something that is, you know, battle tested, that it's pretty applicable. You just essentially import a CSS style sheet and you specify the query selector for the text node that you want, and it just dumps out the content of that text node. So I'm going to work on it. I'm not sure if I'm going to get there, but in the meantime, if you need to actually leak the contents of a text node, the research by Michael Bentowski, linked in the description, I got you, will be very helpful for that, and does show a basic POC of how you can dynamically generate these ligatures over time to leak the full value of a text node.
You know, I'm thinking we might just have to start publishing some research blog posts on our website.
But see, here's the thing, man. We just get on the pod and then we yap about it, right? And and that saves us the time of having to write it all up. Because I'll tell you, man, I've been writing these presentations for the past like week. I don't know. And the, you know, I wrote the 15 page.
Don't you love writing?
You know,
isn't it great?
There are little pieces of time in which I enjoy writing, right? Like writing the blueprint on how to go full-time bug bounty. Super enjoyed that. Busted it out pretty quickly, you know. Really loved it. But actually taking the super brainy stuff that is CSS injection and trying to break it down and like put it into an article that's easy for people to follow is tricky. And it's tricky to even talk about it on the podcast. So, but
it's really difficult.
Yeah. I do agree though. I think there is definitely some merit to producing some sort of, you know, research papers or essentially write-ups and having it in the text medium. Obviously, Brandon is doing a good job of converting everything that we say in the podcast into the hacker notes and that sort of thing. But I think if we're trying to get a little bit more in depth on these sort of things.
No, I mean, just unique research more.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, that font ligature piece, the scroll bar generation, that stuff is really cool. Definitely check that out. But here is the thing that really sparked this whole thing again, right? Which is Masato Kinugawa essentially submitted a issue to Lava Dome using a new CSS property that I hadn't seen before called Descent Override, which allows you to change the height of each individual character in a font face definition, right? So you're defining a custom font, you define a custom code point, right? You can do the Unicode code point for that specific font and say, all right, this font only applies to like the A character or whatever, and then make the A character super big, right? Super massive. And whenever that character gets typed into the or appears in the DOM, then it, you know, the size inflates drastically. And so essentially he's able to do all of this definition without actually using a custom font. He uses, I think, just Comic Sans and then this override for the height to leak the content of the Lava Dome value by changing or by detecting changes to the height, like we were talking about. He has access to JavaScript, so he can do that. If you don't have access to JavaScript, it's really tricky to do that. But the revolutionary piece about this is that it doesn't require a custom font to be imported. So you can do this in a scenario where font source is set to something strict in the CSP. Really cool technique. I love the fact that this descent override property exists and allows us to control the, there's another one for width as well, allows us to granularly control the width and the height for a specific character in a font face definition.
Very interesting. And if you look through actually the font face docs for like the font face rule or whatever, like how it gets defined as a custom font face, there's a ton of different descriptors that exist, and there's a lot more that I think also would be great candidates for this sort of, again, this canary behavior. There's font display, which determines how a font face is displayed and whether or not it gets downloaded and shown, and it can behave as a fallback, for example. So what I'm thinking here is like you have a default font face, and then you have your custom font face that has characters that are either invisible or by default not visible or different widths, and then it would fall back if there's no character shown or something like that, or have something that renders slowly. There's something like that. I don't know. I think there's definitely a lot of really interesting candidates in here. There's size adjust. That might be the width one you were talking about. There's font stretch. There's descent and ascent as well.
That's the ones. Those are the ones that he uses to control the height and width of the. Yeah.
Yep.
Very cool.
Size adjust. So yeah, there's a lot of different things, and you know, we've talked about this so many times, and we've gone through the web or whatever HTML docs so many times, that we found like weird consistencies or even inconsistencies, things that are in the doc that do not behave that way at all in the browser, right? Thinking of the base tag. So just because it says that this is how something works doesn't necessarily mean that this is how this works. But if it says that this is how it works, that's also a great starting point
indicator.
This is weird.
Yeah. Yeah,
this is weird.
Dude, you just nerd sniped me with this. Now I'm looking through all of these different properties. There's gotta be stuff here, man. This is exactly
maybe there's some way we can use Shazzer here too, by the way.
Yeah.
Like to fuzz this stuff in mass, or like try all the possible options and figure out what the different permutations and possible selectors and descriptors and stuff that you can use here.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So let me add one more thing to this. Okay. So of course, for us to leak the contents of a text node, it has to be displaying that text, right? For the font to be loaded and for it to trigger and for us to be able to do the whole ligature dance or whatever, right? Here's something crazy that I didn't know, Joel.
Okay.
You can apply display block to a script tag, and then all of a sudden the script tag the content, like the actual content of the script tag, the JavaScript, will just be displayed on the screen like it was like a p tag. Isn't that crazy?
It makes you wonder what other
I didn't know that,
you could, like
I,
what happens if you put it on a video tag or an audio tag or a iframe or
well, I think a lot of those would just, you know, display the actual, you know, feature. But the crazy thing to me about this is, like, I don't know, I just didn't think of
what if
the
you put
contents
it on a style tag.
Yeah, right. I just didn't think that the contents of a script tag, I didn't think of it as like a text node, but it is text, you know, it's inside of a script tag. So if you just
apply...
Well,
it does make you wonder a little bit about the order of operations as well, around like, it probably gets evaluated and then like CSS gets applied later, just sees it as like an element or something. But then does that apply to, like, can you do that to the head tag or like what, you know, like what, where does that end? Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm sure there's lots of other, you know, weird niche cases with this, but the reason why the script tag is so big is just like we were talking about before, is like there are these you know, blobs of JSON, the window.state or whatever, and they're normally, you know, prefixed by the same thing, right? Window.state equals and then big massive blob, right? That is a dream come true for this sort of text-based data exfiltration piece, right? Because essentially, when you define a prefix, you eliminate a bunch of like variants. Like if AB appears in like six different spots in the whole, you know, script blob, then you could have some problems. But you know, if you have a prefix that only appears once, then that really helps. So setting, you know, display block to a specific script tag, and then using these font ligatures to extract things like PII, API tokens, CSERF tokens, all those sort of things. Really awesome way to exploit CSS injection. And I'm kind of salty because I've had CSS injections and I put so much research into CSS injections and I totally did not know about this technique. And
you're gonna hate me because I just found more stuff, but I'm not gonna derail you. I'm gonna send it. I'll send it.
Just send it to me, man. We'll review it, and then maybe I can find. No, don't send it to me right now, Joel. What are you? I'm trying to podcast here, man. Okay, very interesting. So, display block can actually display a script tag, and then you use the text node based, font ligature based, recursive import based leak method to actually leak the contents of your text node, which will result in hopefully account takeover or at least CSERF, or I guess at minimal PII leakage in most applications. So very cool stuff there. I know I had one other thing that I wanted to talk about with this before we call it. Your cat is very distracting right now.
Because she wants attention.
She does. Oh, I did want to shout out two blogs, okay, that were kind of helpful with this. And I will shout those out right after I mention one other piece, okay? So the tweet that I saw that you mentioned that was just all in Japanese and was from Masato Kinugawa was essentially his research on font ligatures and how they are affected by the before pseudo attribute, what is it? Pseudo class, essentially the thing that allows you to add text before a certain text blob, right? Or a certain text node. And essentially what he did is there's this Japanese word kabushiki gaisha, and that's like a, like, for if we were going to put it in English, it's like limited liability company or something like that, right? Okay. And it's got, you know, it has to be at the end of like all of these like names and stuff like that. And it's got a specific ligature for it, right? Where they kind of put it in a square rather than to have it all typed out. And so what he shows in this tweet is that you can actually use the before attribute, the before and content CSS features to trigger these font ligature sequences. So let's say like you've got a font ligature that requires four characters and you have three of the characters, but then you put the first character in the CSS before before content, you add it to the text node with before content, that will actually trigger the font ligature to occur, and it will be converted into a you know, that single glyph.
Even though it's broken up by elements?
Even though it's broken up. Even though the actual text node content only contains 3 of the 4 characters needed, you can add that character with the before content feature in CSS.
Very interesting.
And so I thought that was really interesting research, and it only affects some browsers. So I'm going to link this tweet in the description as well. Very, very interesting piece. And I think this could also be used in a scenario where you want to add sort of like, you want to start brute forcing from the very beginning of a text node. And there could be overlap with other things at other places in the actual text node itself. So you kind of got to figure out how to get it just at the beginning. And essentially you could use this before attribute to prepend something that's not actually in the character set, right? Like a squiggly line or something like that, and say, okay, the font ligature is squiggly line A, squiggly line B. And since squiggly line isn't going to be anywhere else in that text node, then you know you're brute forcing right from the beginning. And it can increase some reliability and consistency to the font ligature based CSS exfiltration techniques.
Yeah, absolutely. Are you laughing at my cat?
No. Your cat is adorable. I'm laughing at myself saying like font ligature based CSS injection exploitation. Like, it's just so mega niche, man. It's just like, man, this is the epitome of nerdiness. All right, man. I think that, I mean, there's just so many other interesting pieces to talk about here, but I think that was mostly everything that you need to know about essentially how to exploit modern day CSS injections, right? You use the research from Donut on sequential import chaining plus the CSS selectors on attributes to leak attribute values, and then you use this font ligature based stuff to actually leak the value of text nodes. Which is really good. And if all of this doesn't make sense via the audio medium, which I would be very surprised if it did, because this is very complex stuff, I would encourage you to do additional research on how exactly all of this works by checking out these two blogs. Okay, so let me just format my notes a little bit here so that we can know exactly what two blogs I'm talking about. The first one is. Man, why do these have to be so named so weird? One of them is x-c3ll.github.io. And essentially, this is a post on CSS injection primitives that goes back to 2019. And it essentially talks about all of the different techniques you can use in a CSS injection, talking about recursive imports, talking about text node exfiltration via ligatures, talking about HTML attribute exfiltration. This blog post kind of is similar to what I just described in this episode regarding all of these primitives that you can use to do CSS exfiltration. So that's the first one. Definitely check that one out. And then the other one is this blog that I haven't heard of before, that I've never seen before. And it's by this guy who is who calls himself a developer with security interests, right? And essentially, if you go and look at the blog, he was a part of some writing competition in Taiwan or something where he had to write like a blog post every day for 30 days. And so what he chooses is just like, get to the most like technical CSS injection, XSS breakdowns, CSS injection breakdowns. And it's really freaking quality stuff.
So random.
So this blog post really made it a lot easier for me to understand the whole font height difference plus first line plus scroll bar technique, which Masato used in one of those things in conjunction with the descent override to actually leak the characters character by character. And he's got a really great description of that whole technique. So if the whole height width difference thing doesn't make sense to you, then I'd recommend this blog, Beyond XSS, Exploring the Web Front-End Security Universe, at asx87410.github.io. You're welcome for reading that out.
So memorable.
Yes, just super memorable. So yeah, that's where to get the additional research on CSS injection. And Joel, hopefully you and I can sit down after this episode and kind of hash out some of these things, because I would really like to put a server out there, ideally a server that we could actually just do it for everybody, but at minimal, a GitHub repo that essentially allows you to just do essentially what Portswigger Research did with blind CSS exfiltration, where you essentially just have one URL that you import and it just dumps everything for a given query selector or something like that. I think that'd be really helpful. So
yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So keep an eye out in the critical thinking Discord for me trying to drop that. And I'm not sure I'll get to it this week because I got a bunch of stuff I got to prep for DEF CON and stuff like that. But I will get to it eventually or else I won't sleep. So
eventually.
All right, man. Anything else you want to add here at the end?
I think that's it, dude. This has been a really interesting one. I got a lot of follow-up.
A lot of nerd swiping.
Ideas. Yeah, I just deleted some thing from the doc. And on that note, before I delete the entire content of this episode.
Yeah, on the episode where we're like, it will actually be in the description too.
That's great. Just delete all the notes.
All right, man. That's the pod, right?
That's the pod.
All right, peace, guys. And that's a wrap on this episode of Critical Thinking. Thanks so much for listening. And if you want more Critical Thinking content, head over to ctbb.show/discord. Join the Discord. There's lots of great conversations and chats going on over there. And if you want to support the show, there's the Discord subscriber tiers, which give you access to masterclasses, AMAs, hackalongs, exclusive scripts, and an exclusive chat channel with us. We'll see you there.